The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon. Michael Schratt is a private pilot and military aerospace historian. He has lectured across the country on the unique subject of what he has dubbed mystery aircraft. Classified propulsion systems buried deep within the military-industrial complex. He was a guest speaker at the Oshkosh Air Venture event 2006-2007, the world's largest air show. Michael has developed a number of contacts which have had firsthand experiences dealing with classified black programs, including former U.S. Air Force pilots, retired naval personnel, and aerospace engineers that have maintained a top-secret, sensitive, compartmented information clearance. In an effort to expose government fraud, waste, and abuse, Michael devotes much of his free time to researching aerospace technical documents, conducting interviews, and traveling to multiple university archives. As a concerned citizen, it is his belief that it is our constitutional obligation to question authority and demand an accounting of special access programs that bypass congressional oversight and public scrutiny. And we are honored to have him as a guest on our show. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you. So, Michael, at your speeches, you give a detailed and highly illustrated presentation where you present an exhaustive examination into the Leonard Springfield UFO crash retrieval cases. Now, unfortunately, we're unable to show this illustrated presentation on the radio. Uh-huh. So your narrative will have to suffice.
Okay, well, I'll run through the slides and we can just talk through them. That's fine too, you know, okay. That works as well.
Good. First of all, tell our listeners who Leonard Stringfield was.
Okay, well, Leonard Stringfield is the gentleman who coined the term UFO crash retrieval. Over a period of about 30 years, he collected dozens and dozens of these firsthand military witnesses, people who loaded these craft on 18-wheeler tractor trailer lowboy trucks and shipped them to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He had people who were pathologists, who were medical doctors, who were x-ray technicians, who actually dealt with the autopsies. He spoke to people who handled the debris. So we're talking about firsthand military witnesses, names, dates, locations, original sketches, notes, letters, all of it. He compiled all this information. And in 1978, he gave a lecture called Retrievals of the Third Kind at the MUFON Symposium in Dayton, Ohio, not too far from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And it literally caused an international sensation. Totally. But there was some pushback because the agreement that Leonard had made with his witnesses is that he was allowed to preserve an important part of our national history by telling their accounts, but he had to keep their names under wraps. And so there was no way to independently verify these sources. And that's where the pushback came in.
Yeah, well, I can see their concern. I mean, if you can't say who the expert witness is, you don't know. It could be Joe Blow on the street, right?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
So there are so many events in the presentation that I don't know. We can't cover it in 1 hour space, but let's give it a try, okay?
All right. Yeah,
What
that's
are the
fine.
What were these witnesses' claims, and what evidence were they able to provide?
Okay, so Leonard's sources were the following. Three-star U.S. Air Force generals, U.S. Air Force fighter pilots, astronauts, commercial pilots, air traffic controllers, neurosurgeons, pathologists, theoretical physicists and mathematicians, U.S. Army officers, U.S. Navy officers, military police, high-level Pentagon officials, top military brass, scientists and engineers who worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and other government facilities. So these are the sources of where Leonard got this information here. And I'm going to kind of move along here, and it's okay because people can kind of make this up in their own mind here. I'm going to talk a couple of little biographical parts about Leonard here. He was born in 1920. He grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. By the time he graduated from high school in 1939, he'd already memorized the entire dictionary. So, in other words, we're talking about this is the kind of guy that you want to have all this catalog. It should be filtered to him because he has got this fantastic memory. He joined the military as soon as he heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. After the war, he was employed by a chemical company in Ohio, and he retired after 30 years. He wrote two books, Inside Saucer Post 3-0, back in 1957, another book in 1977 called Situation Red, the UFO Siege. And then we kind of talked about this next bullet item here. His lecture on UFO crash retrievals at the 1978 MUFON Symposium in Dayton, Ohio, caused international sensation. Yeah, this was the kickoff point to all of this here. He passed away on December 18th, 1994. I'm going to go to the next one here. This is Cincinnati Inquirer newspaper clipping, July 19th, 1993. And it says, author continues quest for truth about UFOs. And here's his quote here. Quote, "What I've collected has staggering implications for mankind. This would be the biggest thing since Christ, really." Yeah, and it would be the biggest thing. I mean, that's a bold statement, but it absolutely would be a huge event. Now, for anyone who wants to follow along, and I know we're only hearing this in audio terms here, but if you want to follow along with this presentation and you want to get all of the intricate details regarding how many bodies were recovered, what type of crash was recovered, where these vehicles were being sent, it might be Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, it might be Eglin Air Force Base, it might be Edwards North Base Complex. If you want all of the details on the crash retrievals, there's a book you have to get. It's called UFO Crash Retrievals, The Complete Investigation Status Reports 1 through 7 by Leonard Stringfield, 1978 to 1994. Over the years, he published these occasional status reports, he called them. This book, which you can get on Amazon, and it's not cheap, it's about $79, but it's worth it because it gives you all of the details from his firsthand military witnesses, people who held the bodies, people who loaded the craft. It's all in this book. So where I'm basing all my illustrations from is directly from this book. And I'm going to give you the page number, the location, and the case number so people can follow along. All right. Now, one thing I want to point out about this book is that if you decide to get this book, what you're going to find out is it's very text rich. There's no drawings, there's no sketches, there's no illustrations, barely of any kind. So you're left with your own imagination to come up what you feel in your own imagination what these Crash Retrieval cases look like. So what I've done, and I've made it a crusade over the last 4 years, is to dig deep down into this publication, pull out the most mission-critical cases, and commit those to a refined drawing and a full-color 3D rendering. And that's what we want to talk about here today. All right. Also want to highlight a book from Ryan Wood, good friend of mine. He wrote a book called Magic Eyes Only. 20 years ago, he published this book. He just recently updated this book with 104 crash retrieval cases around the world. Now, if we hook that up with Leonard's publication that we just talked about, he has 119 crash retrieval cases. So now we're pushing 120 crash retrieval cases. And I kind of like to err on the side of conservative portion for numbers here. Even if we took out 50 cases, we're still looking at 150 crash retrieval cases. So bottom line, the point I'm making here is we only need one of these.
That's it.
Authentic, right?
Do any of these cases overlap?
Some of these cases overlap, yes. Okay. Some of them do. But bottom line is we're looking at a good solid 150 cases. We only need one of them to be authentic, and the whole concept of UFO crash retrieval non-existence completely falls apart here.
That's right.
So let's go ahead and get into the cases now. This first case is in 1942, and this is, we're talking about 5 years before Roswell here. This is UFO crash retrieval, 1942, at an Army base north of Georgia that even Leonard didn't know where this was. This is page 319 in his book, and he talks about a craft that when it came down, it hit the side of this Army facility, and it ripped open a hull breach on the side of the craft. This thing was about 15 feet in diameter. It was 10 feet high. It had markings wrapped around the outer circumference of the craft itself on the lower side. And I want to talk about these three levels here. So level number one, which was an upper deck, had a display panel with buttons and switches. That was level number one. Level number two had what looked like an external wraparound window. And in back of that wraparound window were four bar stools, essentially. Level number three was an entryway hatch. Now, there were four crew members taken alive. They were 5 feet tall, 90 pounds, large black eyes, milky white skin. And the point being here on this case is that the hieroglyphic type writing was seen both on the inside of the upper dome section and on the external side on the lower portion of the lower circumference of the craft itself. Mm-hmm. And there's at least four other cases with writing, and this also includes cases from Ryan Wood and his publication. So what I'm getting at here is there's got to be a transnational team of linguistic experts and engineers who are trying to decipher what all these writings mean. There has to be a group doing this.
I'm sure that they've been devoted to that since Roswell.
Absolutely.
I don't know as if they're – I think they have to go by earthly writings, you know, and hieroglyphics from – made by humans.
Well, they could probably use that as a guide, but we have no idea if there's any correlation. It could be completely different. So who knows? But over the last 80 years, you would think they made some progress. We would hope so. We would hope so. All right, next case. Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio, 1946. This is still before Roswell. We've got two witnesses on this case. One is an avionics mechanic. He worked at Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio. Mm-hmm. His son, 6-year-old Tex Martin, was with him when all this went down. And they are what I believe to be hangar complex number 4, which is still at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base today. This is page 242, 243 in the book. Now, this 6-year-old boy, Tex Martin, he was getting very good grades. So his father allowed him to join him for a week to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio. And they're in this adjoining cafeteria that connects up to the main hangar here. And there was a soda pop vending machine inside this cafeteria. And this janitor decided, hey, I think this 6-year-old boy seems like a nice guy. I think I'm going to buy him a soda pop. So he asked his father if it's okay. His father said okay. So this janitor hands this guy a soda pop. And the second he did that, this connecting doorway that led into the large hangar, a military guard walked through this door, and this little 6-year-old boy got a look inside this hangar. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, he was at the right place at the right time, and he peeked inside this hangar. And what he said he saw is really incredible. About a 20-foot diameter dish-shaped craft on tripod landing gear legs. He said that there were two 18-wheeler tractor trailer lowboy trucks there that had unknown tarp debris with chains on the top of it. And then he said that there were three ET bodies on the hangar floor, and they appeared to be covered with some type of blanket. They were on stretchers, and they were hanging, just sitting on the hangar floor there. And he's looking at all this. Now, I want to mention that his father saw all this as well. So we don't have to rely on the testimony of the 6-year-old child. We have two eyewitnesses that saw this actually. The father saw it as well. And that's the key point of this. This craft, again, was about 18 feet in diameter. It was off-white in color. It had two rings wrapped around the outer circumference of the craft itself. So again, this is 1946, Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio. Now, next case is at the same location, and it's at the same date. So it's, again, 1946. In this case, our witness is a private who worked in records management. And this one comes from Space, the Final Frontier, page 59 by Clark McClellan. So I want to highlight his publication here. And what he describes is a very interesting disc-shaped craft that's 15 feet in diameter. It's 7 feet tall. It has a series of rectangular windows wrapped around the outer circumference. Now, I want to talk about the exterior of this thing. Highly polished mirror reflective exterior. No welds, no visible seams, no socket head cap screws, no hex head cap screws, no writing of any kind. This thing came in from Arkansas on a railroad flat car. So they shipped this thing all the way over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base by a railroad flat car. And basically, what this private records management described is he saw this craft on the hangar floor. It had a central column that ran through it. There was nothing inside this thing. It was antiseptically sterile. Now, I want to mention that he said that on the left window from center was an area where they were trying to breach the hull of the craft with diamond tip drill bits. So what happened here is his friend, who was a military guard, he told this private records management, I got something I want to show you. This came into the base. So he showed him this craft, and basically he was able to show him this craft when they were changing shift with these white lab coat technicians. So there was nobody else in the hangar. It was just this military guard here. And he said that when he walked in and saw this thing, it was sitting on the hangar floor. There was a tarp that was partially folded up on the right-hand side. In the foreground, there was a metal toolbox with an electric drill and a diamond tip drill bit. So obviously, they were trying to pierce the windows of this thing, and they could not do it. They could not do it. And this is back in 1946. So, as we kind of go through these cases, the craft count goes up, the body count goes up. And you would think by now, after spending billions on classified programs within the military industrial complex, we would have got something for our money. We would hope so. We would hope so. All right, let's continue on here. Now,
Before we
go ahead.
continue, I'm sorry, but I have to remind my listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm your host, David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Michael Schrett, investigator. And are you with MUFON?
Technically, no, but I've been a member before.
Okay. But he investigates UFO crashes and And so we're getting a real history lesson here. And I did want to ask you before we went on, according to Stringfield's sources, was Roswell a real UFO event?
According to the Stringfield reports, yes, it was.
Okay, that's all I wanted to
It
know.
was. Yep.
Go on with your list of crashes.
No problem here. Now, the question is, in 1946 and 1947, who would have a need to know about all this, right? Well, I want to point your listeners to a letter from General Nathan F. Twining. He was the base commander there.
Mm-hmm.
This is to Air Force Brigadier General George Shulgin. The date on this letter is September 23rd, 1947. And here he says, "The phenomenon reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious." Now, if someone of his stature says that this is real, this is something that we should take to heart, because mm-hmm. this letter talks about the form, fit, and function of these vehicles. It talks about the flight path of these vehicles. This is really a bombshell document, something that we want to consider. All right, let's continue on to the next case here. Papagos Indian Reservation, west of Globe, Arizona. This is January 1947. So we're still not even at Roswell. We're already 2 and 3 in here, and we're not even at Roswell. Mm-hmm. So north of Superstition Mountains, our witness served in the U.S. Navy during World War II. Page 93, case A10 within the book. Now, in this case, a very interesting dish-shaped craft came down. Now, our primary eyewitness was with an associate. They're driving down this unimproved road in a Jeep, and they come across two military guards, and they're stopped immediately, and they're told to vacate the area. They're not supposed to be here. These guards were armed, told them to get out of here immediately, but it was already too late because what they saw another 100 feet down the road off to the left was about a 30-foot diameter dish-shaped craft, came in at about a 45-degree angle. It had a low-rise dome on top. There was a series of indented windows wrapped around the outer circumference of the craft itself, and then two rings wrapped around the outer circumference. And they're looking at all this. Can you believe this? I mean, so eventually they did leave the area, but that is the report on what this craft looked like. And this whole concept of double rings and indented window sections, that pops up on a couple of these different cases here. So it's not completely unknown. Now, besides tracking down the craft and the bodies, I also like to investigate where the hardware disappeared, like all the metal fragments and all the pieces of debris, and where did all this go? Well, within the Stringfield collection, there's a page of notes that talk about something called Foot Brothers Gear and Machine Company. That's what I want to talk about right now. According to Mr. Robert Helmold, Foot Brothers Gear and Machine Company of Chicago conducted metallurgical analysis on pieces from a flying saucer that crashed in Arizona back in 1947. So now we've got something to bite down on here. So, of course, I started digging. I wanted to find out about this company. This is Chicago Tribune, January 15th, 1955. It says it makes gears as large as 21 feet in diameter and weighing 45,000 pounds, and others small enough to put on a watch chain. Its gears are found on airplanes of all types, including jets and helicopters. In a year, it will make thousands of different gears for use by industry. So the bottom line is, if there was something that was recovered in Arizona that resembled like an arc radius with teeth on it, and the government didn't know exactly what they were looking at, mm-hmm. they would send it to this, you could call it a contractor, a machine shop that has expertise on gears. I mean, they do everything at this company. I know people can't see this, but this is from the Hendrickson's Commercial Register. This is 1909. We've got a guy standing up, and this gear is as large as this man here. So this is exactly the place that you would want to take any kind of unknown debris that looked like a gear. So it's completely checking out the boxes. It's consistent with what we know about this type of debris that's recovered. All right, next one. White Sands Missile Range, July 4th, 1947. Our source is a technical sergeant in the U.S. Army Air Force, and this is page 196 in Leonard's book. So if anyone wants to follow along and get the book later, page 196. I've got a slide of the perimeter of White Sands Missile Range. Now, where this thing came down was on the upper section of the perimeter of the range. And what was actually recovered is nothing short of astounding, because this thing was huge. This is not a 20-foot disc or a 30-foot disc. This is a 150-foot diameter dish-shaped craft, kind of came down at about a 30-degree angle on one of these sand dunes there at White Sands Missile Range. It had a low-rise dome on top. This whole thing took place at night. So what they ended up doing is bringing in these light-alls. They had these searchlights. They had spotlights. The whole thing was very well lit up. They had people with Geiger counters walking around this thing, checking for radiation. They had people with still cameras taking photographs of the whole scene. They also had people with motion picture film reel cameras that were documenting the entire retrieval operation. So the bottom line is that this thing was excruciatingly well lit and well documented. So what is the takeaway on this particular case? This is the actionable item. Since still photography and motion picture film was recorded of this event, senators and congressmen with the appropriate security clearances should track down and utilize this evidence for future public hearings. Yeah, this is what it's going to take to move this entire field forward. I believe it is the crash retrieval operations which is going to be the vehicle that facilitates disclosure. Nothing less than the crash retrievals. We don't need any more CE1 or CE2 cases anymore. We don't need any more sighting reports anymore. We've got thousands of those. Mm. What we need at this time in 2024 is the actual hardware, the bodies, and the craft. That's what we need. And this is what needs to be put forth in open public hearings for the entire world stream live across the world on all streaming platforms. Well, and this is the only way.
David Grush said that he had seen some of this debris and was willing to show it to Congress. And then they went into a skiff after the public hearings and talked about it, and just wondering if some of that debris has been seen by Congress.
Well, here's the thing. Recently, they just killed the UAP disclosure legislation a second time in a row here. So what you can see is our political leaders have failed in their responsibility and obligation in order to provide this information to the public. They feel that we're not ready for this. Mm-hmm. So this is what we're doing here. And you can see what they're doing is they're kicking this can down the road. And if we don't make a management decision and take the bull by the horns, we're all going to be here another 50 years and we still won't know what's going on. So that's why it is incumbent upon us to track down Leonard Stringfield's remaining legacy witnesses and get these people into congressional hearings, which could possibly result in getting a lot of this information dislodged. That's the critical timing that we're in right now. The bottom line is this is the final curtain call on crash retrievals. Because if we don't track these people down, they will be completely passed away. And at that point, it will be cover up complete. Mm-hmm. It will absolutely be cover up complete. All right, next one. UFO crash retrieval 1947, seen at a warehouse at Berkeley University, of all places, right? Mm-hmm. In this case, we've got the guy's name. His name is Albert Bruce Collins. He's now deceased. He's a metallurgical engineer. Source, page 197 in Leonard's book. Now, what did this guy see here? Well, he was at the right place at the right time when this 18-wheeler tractor trailer lowboy truck backed into the warehouse at Berkeley University. And he said that this craft was egg-shaped, 30 feet across, 15 feet tall. Now, it had a huge breach in it, like a cracked egg. It literally looked like a cracked egg. And when he looked inside, he saw what was termed a 36-inch diameter central core or yolk, like an egg yolk. That's what it looked like inside. Now, on the front part of this thing, there was a composite panel. There was another composite panel that wrapped around the outer circumference of this internal central core or egg yolk. Now, off to the right, there was what looked like an implosion, and there was debris and shrapnel coming out of this lower right section here. And he's looking at all this. Of course, we did a full color rendering, and it's incredible what has been retrieved and kept under wraps by the public. And you can kind of see what they've done, and these people are, they're fantastic. They're very good at what they do, providing disinformation, muddying the waters, ridiculing witnesses. It's really incredible they've been able to keep this under wraps. And I want to mention that during the World War II time period, this particular subject was classified so high, it was in point of fact classified higher than the atomic bomb. It was classified mm-hmm. above top secret.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Timothy Good's book is called Above Top Secret. It's an homage to this security clearance classification. All right, let's move on. Carrot Patch, south of Salinas, California. This is July, August 1947. This particular craft was seen by two 19-year-old workers in a nearby field. Again, this is 1947, July, August. Now, the foreman had saw this craft come down the night before. Next morning, he alerted the two witnesses, the two 19-year-old workers. And what he described, and I've got an original sketch from the report here, this was not a large craft. This was 9 feet in diameter. It was 4 feet tall, had a flat top. And then there's this, again, double row of indented windows wrapped around the outer circumference of the craft itself. In the report, there was 3 pages of descriptions. There was an original sketch, and there was actually a map with X marks the spot. So we know exactly where this thing came down. So if we could go back in time to the exact minute and second of when this all happened, I believe I could get anyone within plus or minus 300 feet of where this thing came down. That's how close we've got this map here describing where this happened.
Hmm.
Now, to get on with our story here, one of these 19-year-old workers got up enough courage to walk over to this thing, and he hit this thing with his boot. He made physical contact with this. Again, this thing is 9 feet in diameter. About 4 minutes later, there was a convoy that arrived on site of military vehicles. So we had at least two Jeeps there. There was a 6x6 troop transport covered. It was towing a trailer. These 19-year-old workers were ordered to get out of the area immediately. They're not supposed to be there, but they did watch these military personnel manhandle this craft, lift it up onto the trailer. They covered it with a tarp, put two chains over it, and got out of there immediately. So this is another one of these rapid response military retrieval operations. Now, I want to talk about Danny Sheehan here for a minute. Mm-hmm. He plays a role in this story. For people who don't know who he is, he obtained degrees from Harvard University and Harvard Law School. He's a large advocate for UFO transparency. Back in 1977, he was given a special one-time-only security clearance to investigate some very interesting files at the Library of Congress. And I want to talk about exactly what he saw here. First thing to mention is that these were the classified files associated with Project Blue Book. So mm-hmm. we're talking about the classified files. We are not, this is not to be confused with the unclassified files of Project Blue Book, which have long since been declassified and sent to the National Archives. So I'm not talking about those.
Mm-hmm.
The photos were accessed by Danny Sheehan at the Madison Building basement during January of 1977 under the direction of the Congressional Science and Technology Committee and Marcia Smith at the Congressional Research Service. So that's how he got this information. All right, so he walks into the James Madison Memorial Building. For anyone who doesn't know where that is, so if you do a top view looking down on the Capitol, and you, I suppose you would go to the right where you have the Library of Congress, and then just south would be the James Madison Memorial Building. He walks into the building. He takes the elevator to the basement floor, gets out of the elevator, walks down a long corridor. He's met with two guards. They check his ID. It is Denny, so they let him in. He walks into this medium-sized room where there is a microfilm reader and there's a rollable dolly with documents on there and various microfilm reels. And what he starts doing is he starts feeding one of these reels through the reader, takes it up on the pickup reel on the other side, and he starts streaming through this microfilm reel. And would you believe it? He saw three photographs that depict a UFO crash retrieval operation. Didn't say where it was and didn't give a date. And so he's looking at all this. He really can't believe what he's seeing here. And it dawned on him that he doesn't have a lot of time here to go through all this. And so what he ended up doing is he took out his legal notepad and he paged through all the blank pages to the very backing where there's this cardboard backing. And he projected the image of this crash retrieval scene down onto what you would call the projector plate on this microfilm reader here.
Mm-hmm.
And he proceeded to trace one-to-one scale these hieroglyphic type writings that were written on the outer circumference of this upper dome of the craft itself. So he was projecting the image down onto the cardboard backing. He traced all the symbols, and then he was getting ready to leave. He packed up his things, was walking out. He was checked again by the two security guards. They let him go. He starts walking back to the elevator through the long corridor, and one of these guards stopped him and said, "Wait a minute, what's that in your hand?" And it was his legal pad. And the guy said, "I need to see that." Mm-hmm. So he handed this legal pad to the guard. And this guard is flipping through all the blank pages. Well, he never got to the cardboard backing. He gave it back to Danny, and Danny walked out the facility with this. I mean, this is a great story. Fantastic story. And he's talked about this before. I'm not making this up. He's talked about this in multiple interviews.
This was a TV show before it was a radio show. And I had Danny Sheehan on that TV show, and he told the story. Yeah.
Oh, he does. Okay, good, good. So I thought, well, why don't we kind of get an idea what this thing actually looks like? Instead of just talking about it, let's see if we can vet out the details here. So I met with Danny. It's been about 4 months now at a restaurant. My friend Rudy Gardea was with me, and we sat right next to him, and we said, okay, Danny, what did you see? Draw this thing for us. You know, give us an idea what this thing looked like. So he did. I've got the sketch here of his napkin sketch. He's got this 30-foot disc-shaped craft tipped up at a 30-degree angle. Now, this was a winter-type scene, so there was snow on the ground. It left a debris trail. There were four men in the scene. They were all wearing these winter parkas. They had these furry flanges on them. Three of the men had still cameras. They were documenting all this. There was one guy that had a dual-reel shoulder-mounted motion picture film camera. He documented all of this. And so Danny's seeing, there was about three photographs in this collection here. And, you know, he can't believe what he's seeing. It's incredible. He's got a sketch of what these hieroglyphic type writings look like. So we went through this refining process going with Rudy, and we were vetting out details. We sent it over to Danny for his approval. And he kept saying, no, that's not quite right. And we had to refine this thing. This took 3 weeks. He almost gave up on the process. But when we finally got close, it kind of dawned on me that what Danny was trying to tell us is that the viewing perspective was incorrect. We had to take the whole scene and rotate about 90 degrees counterclockwise, and then we finally got what we were after here. And when we showed our refined drawing to Danny, he said, that is about the closest you're going to get, with the exception of seeing the actual photograph of the camera itself. So in a nutshell, that is what Danny describes. So, you know, I've got the original sketch from Rudy here, and then I put out a call for a contest, $100 contest for the first person to provide a photorealistic color rendering of this scene. I had entries from all around the country, all around the world. People helped me. And so there's some people that did some really nice full color renderings. I've got that in my slide presentation here. And it really makes it come alive. It's photorealistic. We're at the theoretical bleeding edge of technology of what can be typed in within an image generator. and then, maybe working with Photoshop. So really well done. It's got that realistic approach to it here.
I'll take one more moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're talking to Mr. Michael Schrat. He's an author and investigator of crash retrievals of UFOs.
Within the time remaining here, I'm going to talk about the $64 million question. So we talked about craft and everything. Now, where are the files for all of this kept here? There's a page notation within the Stringfield collection. It says, where are the top secret files on UFO crash retrievals being stored? That's the big question. Well, according to this source, they are kept in three large computer banks spread throughout the country. One location is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. That's not a surprise. We knew that for
No, I
decades.
was going to say, of course.
Yeah, that's no big surprise. It's a no-brainer. Number two, CIA headquarters, McLean, Virginia. Number three, NSA headquarters, Fort Meade, Maryland. Those are the three locations. Now, he also concluded by this statement here, quote, they will bend in any direction to keep them secret. So when you talk about the physical evidence, the documentation, the photographs, the gun camera footage, the film footage of these crash retrieval operations, now you're dealing with the varsity team. That's why this guy said that they will bend in any direction to keep them secret. These guys play for keeps. They don't play games. I mean, this is the big time here. All right, so we talked about the where are the documents? Now we want to talk about the craft. Where are the craft stored? All right, number one, CIA headquarters, McLean, Virginia. Number two, MacDill Air Force Base, Tampa, Florida. Number three, Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, Goldsboro, North Carolina. So what you can see here is one of the ways they've kept this under wraps is they diversified their portfolio. They've got craft in one location. They've got craft at MacDill Air Force Base. They've got craft at Homestead Air Force Base. They've got craft at Edwards North Base Complex. So they operate on the principle of no single point failure. They're going to diversify their portfolio and spread these assets around the country. It makes sense. By default, they have to do this. They absolutely have to do this. I think we've got time for one more here.
Right on.
C-119 flying boxcar, Sierra Madre Valley, Mexico, prior to 1951. This would have been 1948 time frame. This is an engineer who worked in highway construction, page 32 in the book. This craft was 9 feet in diameter. I know this because if you take a tape measure and you measure the interior walls of the cargo bay on the C-119, it's 9 feet, 10 inches. We have to allow 5 inches of clearance on either side. That gives us a 9 foot diameter dish-shaped craft. So we've got this highway construction engineer. He's helping the U.S. military load this craft into the back clamshell doors of the C-119. And he said that there were three bodies recovered. When he knelt down and actually touched their skin, their faces, their skin came off on his fingers. And
Oh.
so this was a gruesome scene here, but this is talked about within Leonard's publication. And I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to join you today. My goal here is just to preserve an important part of our national history through the use of accurate historical sketches and full color renderings to make these cases come alive.
Okay, well, thank you, but we have a few minutes left.
No, no problem. No
Unless you
problem.
want to run away here, don't run
No,
away on me.
I'm happy to continue on here. Let's do a couple more cases here.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah, go ahead.
We had Scott and Suzanne Ramsey on
Yeah,
the show a while
sure.
back, and they authored the book The Aztec UFO Incident.
Right.
Allegedly happened in 1948. Do you feel that was a real event?
Well, I give them credit for all the research they did. And in the words of Leonard Stringfield, Scott and Suzanne Ramsey had put more blood, sweat, tears, and research into the Aztec retrieval case than anyone had ever done on Roswell, believe it
Right,
or not.
right.
I don't think they received the credit that they deserve. Now, they talked to some of the surviving oil field workers who got to the scene before the military did, and that information is within the publication. So We've got other witnesses who saw military vehicles at the time. I've got the first run of that book. I believe that they're going to publish a new book with some new understanding, some new information. So, yep, it looks like it's a real case.
Yeah, because they're of course, every case that comes up, you've got the skeptics that's going to try to
Skeptic, of course.
poo-poo it, and tell, well, it couldn't be that way, and what have you. But another question I have for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
The Jackie Gleason slash President Nixon, 1973,
Yes.
ET encounter.
Correct.
Did that actually happen?
Ha
Ah,
It's
right.
just I love that case. That's a famous case. It has reached legendary status. It was never confirmed. It was never confirmed, but I think it's something that we should consider here. Now, just to get back to the date, this is Homestead Air Force Base, February 19th, 1973. First thing to mention is that Jackie Gleason had a huge interest in the paranormal. He had a huge library about UFOs, paranormal activity. They called his house the motherships. He had a home in the shape of a flying saucer. This guy was obsessed with all this stuff. He was very good friends with Richard Nixon. So they go to this golf outing, February 19th, 1973, and they're on the ninth hole at the charity golf outing. This is February 19th, 1973, as the legend goes. And somewhere around the ninth hole, the subject of UFOs comes out. And so Jackie Gleason turns to President Nixon and says, Mr. President, I have an interest in UFOs here. Is there something you can tell me? Can you help me out? And the president turns to Jackie and says, Jackie, well, if you'll be available a little bit later this evening, I might be able to help you with that. So they finish their round of golf. Jackie goes home. And then, as the legend goes, around 11:30 p.m., there's a knock on the door, and Jackie opens it up, and it's the president alone with no Secret Service. And the president says, well, Jackie, you know what we talked about this afternoon? And Mr. Gleason says, yes, Mr. President. And he says, why don't you come follow me? So
See, that's the part I can't wrap around my head. I can't wrap my head around is the president alone without bodyguards. How'd he sneak out?
Yeah, well, apparently that was the case. So
Go ahead.
Richard Nixon drives Jackie Gleason in his own car, and they go to Homestead Air Force Base. They're cleared through the security guard because they recognize it's the president. So he waves them through. And then the president takes Jackie Gleason into what appears to be a large warehouse hangar at Homestead Air Force Base, where he sees what we believe to be six vintage Coke freezers. Nearby, there were large blue-colored bins with debris. Now, inside these Coke freezers were the mangled, burnt remains of childlike ET bodies. They were about 3 feet tall. They were absolutely child-looking. They were mangled. They were burnt. And Jackie's looking in all of these Coke freezers, and he can't believe what he's seen. He's shocked. They drive back. The president drops Jackie Gleason at his house. It's well after 12:30 the next day now. It's early in the next morning, and he plops down on the couch, and he was a changed man, and he was never the same again. In a nutshell, that is the case. Now, we know that the golf outing absolutely took place. There's multiple newspaper clippings. The rest of the story, Paul Blake Smith has done some really good research to indicate that this probably might have been a real event. He believes that Jackie was flown via the helicopter Marine One over to Homestead Air Force Base. So they didn't drive there, they took a helicopter. That's his hypothesis here. I want to hit you with two newspaper clippings. This is Dayton Daily News, May 14th, 1993. Jackie Gleason claimed that Richard Nixon took him to Homestead Air Force Base and he viewed alien bodies. That's written about in a book here, and it isn't just Jackie Gleason, okay? Next one, the Times Tribune, July 5th, 1987. In her unpublished biography of the funny man entitled The Great One, Beverly Gleason's second spouse described a bizarre trip Jackie took with then-president in 1973 to Homestead Air Force Base in Florida to see what she says were the bodies of four dead space aliens recovered by the Air Force. And we'll do one more here. The Times Tribune, March 15, 1985. Larry Bryant, who is the director of the organization, wrote back that there have been reports that MacDill Air Force Base, Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, and Homestead Air Force Base near Miami have all served as way stations or temporary repositories for crash saucer artifacts. So the biography on Jackie Gleason by his ex-wife was never published. That's the problem. So we don't have any documented evidence there, but this is what's claimed, and he was a changed man. So I can't prove it. I haven't met anyone that has additionally tried to prove it. They can't do it. I did go to the Richard Nixon Library, and I went to the Historical Archives Department. I looked through all of the files that were associated with this golf outing. There's no mention of the president flying to Homestead Air Force Base. No. There's no mention of Jackie Gleason in there. I asked for the pilot manifest and records, and I got them. Jackie Gleason's name does not appear on the pilot manifest. So, again, I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I can't find anything to conclusively prove it.
Yeah. Well, at least they didn't take a helicopter.
Yeah, correct.
So it would have to be Nixon was driving all by himself, picking up Jackie Gleason.
And yep.
Which is, once again, I just can't wrap my head around. We got like 7 minutes left, though.
Okay.
So, let me ask you about 1953 Kingsman UFO forced landing. What was
sure,
that?
Sure. We can talk about Kingman. I want to mention, now, when you talk about Kingman, we have to bring in the research of Harry Drew, who is the principal investigator on the Kingman forced landing. However, Harry Drew is no longer with us, so we want to honor his legacy. We want to honor his research. He was a friend of mine. I knew this guy, and he was a meticulous librarian-type researcher. And I want to talk about, we want to mention the date here. This, again, is, let me get you the date here. This is May 18th, 1953, Kingman, Arizona. Now, he claims that the reason this thing came down is that there was a high-powered radar range. And when this saucer came through this range, that experimental radar interfered with the navigation system of the craft itself. Now, it sounds crazy because, you know, if we have these ET races and they're 100 light years away, they could be millions of years in advance. Why are they crashing? Well, that appears to be what happened here. For better or worse, that's how this thing went down. So this thing, it was a forced landing. It was completely intact. He mentions Arthur Stanzel, who is an atomic bomb blast expert. An airplane came from Indian Springs Air Force Base in Nevada, and they flew to Phoenix. There were about 25 engineers on board the plane. They were joined by another 15 that left in a bus from Phoenix, and they drove all the way up to Kingman. Now, this is a General Motors 3301 bus, and this is a four-hour trip. When they got there, it was still dark out. Each member left the bus according to their expertise. And what Arthur Stanzel's expertise was is he was trying to determine, you know, what the closure rate was, what the impact rate was, even though this thing was in good shape. He had to calculate what the angle was and how fast this thing actually came down. On the back of this bus was the inscription, "Notice, do not discuss classified information for emergency exit, push top of window." That was on the back of the bus. This is talked about in the report. Now, when they got there, they saw this craft tipped up at a 30-degree angle. It was still dark out. So they had military police with light all shining down on this thing. They had tents around the area. And he said that there were two groups of military and also medical personnel that tried to walk into this craft, and they got sick immediately because there was some type of propulsion system still going on within the interior of the craft. Now, there were three humanoid-looking bodies recovered, and another one who was the quote-unquote leader of the other three. Somehow they established two-way communication, and the agreement was that the ETs would go with the military on one condition and one condition only, that they do not get separated. That was the agreement that they made. Now, I want to talk about sizes here. This thing was 30 feet in diameter. It was 14 feet tall. It had a series of ridges wrapped around the outer circumference of the outer rim. There was an entryway hatch on the bottom of the craft. So you've got the personnel going in there. They got sick. One of the ETs went back into the craft, somewhat disabled this propulsion system, allowing the military to basically lift this thing up onto an M25 Dragon wagon. And according to Harry Drew, they shipped it across the desert and were trying to get across the Hoover Dam. But the light fixtures on the road there are too narrow, so the only way they could have got it through is to take down all the light fixtures. That would have took too much time. That would have been too obvious.
Yeah.
So according to Harry Drew, they actually went about 200 feet north of the Hoover Dam in what's called a put-in, and they floated a barge down the Colorado River, and they loaded this M25 tank transporter Dragon wagon with the dish-shaped craft up on the trailer onto this, you could call it a barge, and they strung cables across the river and were going across the river, and all of a sudden the cable snapped. And this whole thing now is floating down the Colorado River. And Harry Drew said that the outer rim of the craft itself made contact with the north wall of the Hoover Dam. So this is like a very hasty operation. There's a lot of yelling. There's screaming. They're rushed. They got to get this thing before daylight. They eventually make it to the other side. And he states, and this is where I challenge all of this, he states that the craft was taken to Area 51, Groom Lake, the remote test site. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, back in 1953, there was nothing there but an unimproved dirt strip. Mm-hmm. There were no hangars there. There was no complex there. This is confirmed by Dreamland, the secret history of Area 51, by my good friend Peter Merlin. He's got a photograph that was taken in right around the 55 time frame. He's got it at the 52 time frame, and there's nothing there. U-2's flight plane operations didn't begin until 1955, so there wasn't anything there in 1953. So there is some pushback on this particular case.
Yeah. So, Mike, do you have your presentation on, like, YouTube or something?
Yeah, it's on my YouTube channel. Uh-huh, yep.
So go to YouTube and...
Yep, you type in my name, Michael Schratt, and my YouTube channel will pop up. All of this information is on multiple presentations on my YouTube channel. I've got historical cases there. I've got crash retrieval cases there. Everything is there. It's all fully illustrated and documented.
And do you have a website?
I don't have a website, but I am on X. I'm on Facebook. I've got my YouTube channel. I do have a book that I published a couple of years ago. It's fully illustrated. It's called Dark Files, A Pictorial History of Lost, Forgotten, and Obscure UFO Encounters. And it's got all the illustrations, dates, locations, references of multiple historical UFO cases.
Excellent. Outstanding. So you do have a book. So,
yes.
Michael Schratt, I want to thank you so much for having joined us today and
no problem.
Imparting all of this information. And I'm sure you have a few more that you could tell us about.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
Let's do this again sometime, okay?
No problem. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Yep. Bye-bye.
Yep. And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button. Then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.